Sis. Peter Cis was born in Brno in 1949, but has been living in the US for over a quarter of a century. He won a Golden Bear Award for Best Animated Film at the then West Berlin Film Festival in 1980, before later launching an extremely successful career as a children's author and illustrator. Indeed, he's a seven-time winner of the New York Times Book Review Award for Best Illustrated Work of the Year. His most recent book is The Wall, Growing Up Behind the Iron Curtain. I spoke to Peter Cis at his studio in Soho in New York.
Dad was a filmmaker. He was a documentary filmmaker who was highly regarded in the 50s, so he got position. Sure, he was drafted into the army film, so he moved to Prague with the whole family when I was like 2 years old. So I became already expatriate in that time because I was from Brno, and in that time it was a big issue who's from Prague, who's from Brno. And then we settled in Vršovice, and I went to school in Vinohrady. So again, it was a question of where I'm from. So I was always not quite from where I was living.
You were a DJ on the radio and with a traveling disco, I believe. Were you a bit of a star in Czech or Czechoslovak, on the Czechoslovak music scene in those days?
Yeah, I was a big star. But it just all happened by sort of accident, because my father was making film with the famous traditional jazz musician from England, Ecker Bilk. One of the producers of the film, Francis Hitching, was the producer of the very popular program in England called Ready, Steady, Go. I was like 17, and he gave me about 300 demo 45 records. And I, at that moment, became probably the person with the most records in Prague. I would play to my friends, and in that time, the interest in disco started. So because I had all these records, I became a disc jockey. I believe I was like one of the first three disc jockeys in Prague. And it was in 1969, just after the Russians came. So everything was still sort of without any rules. And so I was a student in the art school, but I was getting lots of money for my performances in the Sluníčko Club in Prague and Olympic. And all of a sudden, all this interest from Brno and all other parts of the country came in. And so I could demand all kinds of money, which for the art student, it was amazing. It was nothing looking at it today. And then I got a radio program, which I think was sort of part of the propaganda scheme, because before things got really bad, they sort of, lots of things opened up so they could sort of close them down again. So there was like 1 year, 2 years of this relative freedom of getting as much money as I wanted. I also was the first disc jockey going from Prague to Poland. And after that, all kinds of rules came in, and we had to pass all kinds of tests and prove our political affiliation. And after that, I dropped it because the art school and the life of the rock star didn't agree together.
You also traveled to the UK and interviewed some of the biggest rock stars at that time.
That was interesting, because I became also a rock journalist, which was pretty obnoxious, because if I look at my articles, I was describing somebody's like guitar solo and really looking at it from the point of view of the musicians. How did I dare to sort of be critical of some of them? But in that time, until like 1971, you could still sort of travel if you had an invitation. And because, again, I was connected through my father's work to this Marquis Martin agency in London, I had free admission to the Marquee Club, and I could meet all the musicians. I think the promoters in England then were also interested in open Czechoslovakia, and they thought it could be a possibility for the concert. So I was able to talk to many, many different rock stars. But it's interesting, because I spent like a week living with the newly formed band called Yes, which then became big. I spoke to Led Zeppelin, who were not, I never heard them, actually, I never seen them live, but this was just when they were formed and before they became big. I spoke to members of the Beatles coming to the Apple Corporation. I spoke to Rolling Stones, to Joe Cocker, but also Bee Gees and John Peel, who was a wonderful disc jockey on Radio 1. So there are lots of memories of that time.
Was it the case in the 70s that you were able to travel and sell your animated films abroad? And were you kind of privileged in a way because of your success?
I was privileged, but because I experienced that sort of youthful traveling when I hitchhiked all over UK and Scandinavia when I was 17, 18, I already knew the feeling of being able to go places. And then what happened after 1972, the borders closed again. I would say half or maybe more than half of my friends left Czechoslovakia and would be living all over the world, from South Africa to Denmark. And then we couldn't travel again, but then I, sort of being disappointed what was going on, what's called normalization, but still being into rock music, I did my animated films based on the over the music track. And I got lucky because 1980 I won the film festival in West Berlin then. And through that I became really a name in the animation, and I became a commodity for the Czech or Czechoslovak export film. So all of a sudden I was able to travel and work in Switzerland, work in London. But it was always sort of difficult because I was paid something, but 70% of my wages would go to the Czech film export. And what was becoming extremely difficult was that I was meeting people outside who couldn't go back because they were, let's say, rock musicians in Zurich. And then I would meet people in Prague who would be rock musicians in Prague, and they couldn't go outside, and the people outside couldn't go back, and I was the one who was traveling. And there were a few occasions when people said, well, how come you can and we can't? And I said, well, I'm an artist, I'm not doing anything bad. But they said, but you're still serving the government, you're still serving the whole ideology. And I didn't see it like that, but it was a sort of feeling which was growing inside of me, and I think was part of the decision then not to really go back, return from the United States.
Well, that's something I'd like to ask you about. You came to the U.S. in 82 and basically never came back or never went back to Czechoslovakia. Tell us that story, please.
Well, I came, as I did before, I came to work on the film in Los Angeles. I had a visa for, 6 months or something to work on the film for the Olympic Games, which were held in Los Angeles in 1984. I came in 82 because animation takes time. I was working on the film for the Olympics, which was just one of the sports of the Olympics. And at the same time, I got approached by the new TV company called MTV to animate a song by Bob Dylan called You Got to Serve Somebody, which for me, as being a disc jockey and music aficionado, it was like a dream come true that I would be doing Bob Dylan's song. So I started to work on that. And in that time, the Communist bloc decided to not to participate in the Olympics, so I got cable in that time. There was no fax or computers to come back to Prague to return immediately. And I was already 30 years old, and this was my life's chance to do this film for Bob Dylan, so I decided not to go back right away. And I thought I will reason with them, but I knew they don't know Bob Dylan as a sort of phenomena, whatever. So I thought I'm in much stronger position to negotiate from outside than going back to Prague and try to, because that happened to me before, and it would just take away my passport. But never I thought I'm in America for like ever or all these years. And then I was actually negotiating for a number of years, and then they sort of realized that I'm not. What happened was that the film really wasn't appreciated by MTV or Bob Dylan. They didn't like it very much. So I was stranded, and I felt like I have nothing to prove why I stayed longer and I would be in trouble. So then I was afraid to go back until I found out that I was really sentenced to two. Actually, I didn't find out until now that I, because somebody sent me all these papers from 1982 till 1986 when the Czech films realized that I'm not coming back, and that somebody in Ministry of Interior decided that I'm not coming back. So I was sentenced to prison for 2 years, which is now so ridiculous, because you see all these people who come from somewhere to make living somewhere else, and if you would have that additional thing and somebody said you didn't come back home to Kansas, so you're sentenced to prison. So that was a situation that unwillingly I sort of stayed here until I became American citizen in May of 1989. So I still had a chance to go back to Prague with the American passport under the communist regime. And then I experienced in Prague all the East Germans going to West German embassy and fall of the wall. And would I have known that, then I would probably not become American citizen, but then who could tell?
How did you get into doing books and doing children's books?
Well, it was desperation time, because after the things didn't work out with Bob Dylan and the films, I was still trying to play some of the ideas in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles was very difficult, and everybody thought my ideas are crazy. And I was sort of like struggling, and I was teaching a little bit, but that didn't work out because I don't think I'm a good teacher. Then I did painted eggs for some woman who collected painted eggs by the famous artist, but she was really stunned when I started to send her many, many painted eggs because it was my only income. And someone who was watching my suffering sent some of my pictures to Maurice Sendak, who was a famous, or who is the most famous American children book author and illustrator. And in my mind, I studied sort of illustration at school, but it was a last resort. I didn't want to do books because it's a lonely job, and I didn't wanted to do rock music and somehow have exposure or whatever. And then Maurice Sendak called me in Los Angeles, and I was surprised because I didn't know why he's calling me, but he thought I sent my pictures to him, and he said, so you want to be in children's books? And it didn't cross my mind, but if you are broke and Maurice Sendak calls you, then you don't start to argue that you don't want to do children's books. So I said, yeah, sure, because I thought it's the instant fame, and I thought I will make a children's book and make film out of it and get out of it again. And he said, you can't be in Los Angeles, that's the worst place to be, you have to come to the East Coast. So I went to the East Coast, and I realized that the rents and life is so even more expensive than Los Angeles, so I have to find some instant solution. So I started to draw for magazines and newspapers, and in that moment I became an illustrator, really.
Člověk ze zoufalství snadno pomáte se.
You're listening to a special Radio Prague interview with the great Czech-born illustrator and children's author, Petr Sis. Once his career in books got up and running, Petr, for a period, had a notable editor, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis.
Unfortunately, we only did one book together about Prague, coincidentally, but first I came with my own ideas to all different publishers. They again thought it's crazy, it's not fitting American market, it's a different sentiment. They would tell me my faces don't look commercially enticing enough. So first I started to illustrate books for other people, illustrated for the newspapers, and slowly I got a chance to do my own stuff. 87 I did my first own book called Rainbow Rhino, then I did a book on Christopher Columbus, which somehow caught attention of Jacqueline Onassis, and she called me from Doubleday and said if I would illustrate a book, and she said, why don't you do a book about Prague, which was shocking to me because I was trying to do a book about Prague until then, but nobody was really interested because she said, oh, Prague, who knows where Prague is, do a book about Venice or do a book about Angkor Wat or something. And she went to Prague incognito in the very first years of after 89, and she loved the architecture and everything, and she gave me chance to do this sort of unusual book about Prague, and we had lots of other plans of things to do, but unfortunately she passed before the book even came out.
You also did a book about Tibet, and that's interesting because your father made some valuable documentaries about Tibet in the 50s and filmed the Dalai Lama at the age of 18, I believe.
Yeah, so that was the inspiration from the beginning, because my father really went to Tibet when he was 29 and I was a little boy, and he told my mother he would be back for Christmas, which he was back for Christmas, but 2 years later. And in the same time I became six and I went to school, and we almost like forgot what my father looked like. So it was a whole sort of trauma of the family, my father going to Tibet. My father came back from Tibet and he had these amazing stories which were sort of like tall tales, and he couldn't tell them outside because Tibet was still very religious, even it was Buddhism. So I was the beneficiary of his stories. He had few books with his photographs and the cameraman who went with him, Josef Vanish, called On the Road to Lhasa. And then he wrote a sort of cookbook which was very popular in Prague called Counting of the Noodles in the Spring Soup. And when I started in books in America, he said, why don't you do the cookbook like I did and put some stories from Tibet? It's going to be very popular. So I was trying to do that, but in that time I had no name, and he used MSG in almost all the recipes. So all the publishers said, no, you can't do that. And they are either cookbooks or they are children's books. And I wish I had more of the presence then, because I think it could have been fantastic book. So I waited all these years for the Tibet book, which then I did when he was diagnosed with the prostate cancer.
You later met the Dalai Lama yourself, I believe. What was that experience like, having heard about him from your dad?
There was, and still it's sort of strange, because when I was a little boy and my father would tell me stories about Dalai Lama, who was 18, 19 in the time he met him, I took it as like sort of fairy tale character, like somebody who's a boy king. And then it was really strange when I went to see him with the first printed copy of the book to show it to him, and I had that opportunity to do that. I was going through Prague and my mother pulled out, because she was collecting all kinds of things, she pulled out the prayer scarf, chadak, which he gave to my father in 1954 or 55, and I wrapped the book in that scarf, so in the way it was like a full circle coming, and he remembered those two young filmmakers who came from communist Czechoslovakia, because it was just before he left Tibet himself. So it was an amazing experience, which was sort of magic in the way.
Tell us about your most recent book, The Wall. It's about a boy growing up under communism. Why did you write that book, and who is it for? Who's it aimed at?
You know, sometimes I'm wondering why I did that book, because it was all my books sort of become a struggle. It always starts as a sort of simple idea, then it becomes much more complex. But this really started with like thinking about things, how they were, and why the things we experience as children were the way they were. And then I was trying to explain it to my kids, who were young teenagers then. And sometimes they would say, oh, Dad, it doesn't make sense and it's not funny. And I started to make doodles of things, what we had to do. And I was trying to tell them we had to have red scarves and we had to march in these parades and we had to go collect hops. And we couldn't do what you can do and we were not free to say what you can say. And sort of from these doodles, I started to pull together this whole sort of memoir of the time. I even had my kids in the first version of the book when they really don't care at all, and they play with the Game Boy or something, so like, this is crazy. And I put in too much information, because if you live in something, you tend to think people know what were certain stamps and certain bureaucracy. And then I realized the children can't deal with it. So I had to strip the whole thing down. And this is really what you see now with this book, which has got different version, slightly different version in Czech. It's longer and simply a version in America, because nobody knows anything about it. And it's just like a book which, when I look at it, I still have many, many more memories, but I thought at least it's a beginning maybe of some discussion.
Was it hard for you to write? And how do you now look back on that era in your own life and in Czechoslovakia?
It is hard, because I get angry now thinking about things which I didn't get angry, because when I was a child or when I was a young man, you take it for a fact that some things which are so stupid and so ridiculous, you just know that's the rule and you sort of follow the rules. At the same time, I feel sort of embarrassed by the fact that when we were into rock music and we would go drinking and talking about Led Zeppelin, there was this whole group of dissidents with Václav Havel, which we thought, oh, these guys are pathetic. They were like these actors and all that. And then I somehow also got memoirs of my friend who played with Plastic People of Universe, Smaila Hlavsa. And I had tears in my eyes, because he, really the book is about him being sort of working class guy who just wanted to play rock music and wanted to grow long hair. And by all these circumstances and the rules, when he didn't fit into the system, he became sort of the political hero, and sort of they tortured him to the point that he died at age 50. So all these things make me angry now, but they didn't make me angry then. And I'm sometimes surprised to people from my generation who say, oh, it wasn't such a big deal and we had a great fun, and don't you remember you were in love with this girl when you were 19? But it sort of reminds me of the stories of Czech writer Arnoš Lustig, who was in Auschwitz at age 16, 17, and then he would fall in love. But it doesn't mean, it's a wonderful thing to fall in love, but it's not the right thing to be in Auschwitz to fall in love. So there is a Czech expression that when people say, didn't we have fun too? I always say like, but it was jako sranda v marnici, which would be like fun in the graveyard or something.
When you write, do you write in Czech or English? And do you translate your own writing?
I do not write if I can help it. I always come up with the pictures, and then I have to somehow always explain what I wanted to say in the picture. So then I would usually now make like some short sentences in English. When things don't work, I try to write it in Czech and see if there's some better solution. But I think I'm trapped in the middle because English will not be my language ever. Even I have to communicate with my family and in everyday life. But the Czech I used to know, I don't use every day. So I'm sort of like in the middle of it. And that makes it very difficult to translate things, because I tried with one of my books about Galileo and I don't like it. I sometimes people don't understand that you, why wouldn't you translate it if you speak both languages? But it's really difficult. But I remember when the book on Darwin came out and it was very well translated, I was surprised how, I was like, wow, I wrote a nice, because I have different comprehension, I guess. If it's your mother tongue, you feel the words and everything in the different way. And it's an interesting problem, which somebody wrote a wonderful book about, Eva Hoffman, called Lost in Translation. And I think forever I will be sort of caught between two realities, really. But that's what gives me inspiration for my books, I would say.
My final question, Peter Sees, is how do you feel today when you return to the Czech Republic, return to Prague?
It depends. Sometimes I feel very much at home, but that is mostly when I would decide to walk at night and the houses still look the same. In the daylight, when I see all the colors, and my family's house is in Nerudova, so it's a very touristy area. So I feel sort of very strange because it just changed so completely. So again, I would go up to the castle at 6, 7 at night when nobody's there, and then it feels like in the old days. But I think the Prague I used to know and I grew up with is gone. Probably, thank God it's gone, because it was all grey and decrepit and everybody was afraid of the police. Now it's another element, and that's what I just realized last week, that I would always come back to Prague because my mother was there, and now my mother has passed. So all of a sudden I realized I'm just stopping by in another city. I still have lots of memories, lots of friends, but something has changed again. So it is home, but the home is also where the children are. So again, I think I'm somewhere. Somebody said, like, it's like you get on the plane and you never get off the plane. You're sort of flying forever.
I was talking to Petr Sees, and that brings us to the end of today's special program on Radio Prague. We hope you can join us for another special show on Sunday, when we hear the incredible stories of film director Wojciech Jasny. But for now, that's all from Radio Prague and myself, Ian Willoughby. We leave you now with some music from Petr Sees's late friend, Mela Hlavsa, and the group Garage.
Muchomurki bíle, budu zbírat v létě.